All right, options traders, listen up. I want to tell you a bit about Public.com. But first, have you ever actually thought about all the fees you're paying to trade options? Aside from the regulatory fees, there are commissions, and most platforms charge per contract fees too. That's what makes today's sponsor, Public.com, so interesting. Public doesn't charge commissions or per contract fees. And in an industry first, they offer a rebate of up to 18 cents per option contract traded. Check it out. If you trade 1,000 option contracts on Public, you'll get up to $180 in rebates. If you trade 10,000 contracts, you could earn almost $2,000. More importantly, the rebate means you can maximize your profits and minimize your losses. To recap, no commissions, no per contract fees, and up to 18 cents on every contract traded. See why NerdWallet recently awarded Public 5 stars for option trading, and start earning up to 18 cents per contract traded, only at public.com. Paid for by Public Investing, options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description, US members only.
Welcome to The J-Row Show. On this podcast, your host, John Rotondi, interviews experts in and outside the world of investing. The J-Row Show dives deep into what it takes to achieve mastery and sustain top-level performance. As a quick reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All opinions expressed by John or any of his podcast guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Now, please enjoy this episode.
I'm John Rotondi, and this is The J-Row Show, a podcast that explores what it takes to achieve mastery, sustained performance, and longevity. The show hopes to uncover the processes, structures, frameworks, and mindsets that professionals put in place to maintain winning performance in their respective fields. Today, I am joined by Chris Pavisi. Chris is the President and Chief Investment Officer of Broyhill Asset Management. Chris, welcome to the J-Row Show.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
So excited to learn from you. I follow you on X now, formerly Twitter, and I enjoy reading your letters. So let's just jump in. Tell us about Broyhill Asset Management.
Sure. So I guess we should start with the family office, which was established in 1980. So the Broyhill family was an old American furniture family. Probably popularized primarily back in the 60s, 70s, maybe 70s, 80s with the Price is Right, which I might be dating myself with that game show. But family sold out of the business in 1980 and established the family office since then. I joined the team in 05, first focusing on one of the family's internally managed equity portfolio. Was promoted to CIO in 2011. And then about a decade later, back in 2022, end of 2022, the board approved the separation of the family's investment arm, establishing Broyhill Asset Management as a fully independent, value-driven investment boutique. I'd say we've got a blend of backgrounds on the team across the arts and sciences, which is a little bit unique in the industry. We can talk a little bit about that down the road. We manage an opportunistic global value portfolio with a relentless focus on capital preservation. I'd say that wealthy families aren't particularly worried about shooting the lights out to get rich with investment results. They're a lot more worried about staying rich. And so it's our job to make sure that that happens. AUM at the firm totaled around $250 million in Q1. Flagship equity strategy is concentrated, tax efficient, and benchmark agnostic. We don't seek to track or outperform any arbitrary benchmark or index. We simply just strive to generate attractive long-term returns with lower risk than broader equity benchmarks. So long bias strategy, but the risk reward there is probably closer to what you'd consider a classic hedge fund than a long only index, in that similar downside protection to a hedged hedge fund with greater transparency, better tax efficiency, and lower fees, really.
I love everything you just said. Concentrated global value fund with a relentless focus on capital preservation. That's right up my alley. So let me ask you, what type of investor are you, in the sense of what types of businesses do you like to buy stock in?
Yeah, I would say at our core, we are value investors, but recognize that value means different things to different people. Mm-hmm. So we invest globally. We own companies in the US, in South America, in Europe, and Asia. I'd say investments outside of the US tend to originate from our domestic circle of competence, mm-hmm. Which is historically centered around consumer, tech, telecom, and media sectors. Although none of those are exclusive by any means, but that's just historically, the pools that we've tended to swim in. I'd say, our focus is on equity securities of mid-sized businesses that operate in a single line of business. Mm-hmm. That's not always the case. We've owned companies with market caps at 100 million or less. We've also owned some of the largest companies in the world. We don't have, hard and fast systematic guidelines around portfolio construction. But over time, the types of investments we've made have generally fallen into three different buckets. The first would be what we call value with a catalyst. Second would be what we call a temporary dislocation. And the third is more of a catch-all. Those are either deep, out-of-favor value investments, could be thematic investments, or it could just be your typical long-term compounder, good business that we can find at a fair price.
So I love those buckets. That's very helpful to understand how you sort of source ideas and look at your universe. Quick, just follow up. So you said, I know it's not a hard and fast rule, but in general, you're focused on businesses with primarily one line of business. Why is that? Is that because it's more predictable to estimate future earnings and cash flows, and just maybe easier to understand, and there's more focus on that one line of business from management?
Yeah, I would say, primarily it's the latter. The first business that immediately comes to mind is Nintendo. Mm-hmm. Right, where that culture, although it started as a card company back in the day, is now just entirely and solely focused on creating entertainment and gaming for its customers. I would say, Brett, not every portfolio, not every company in the portfolio fits that bill. But if we could assemble a portfolio of companies of stocks that were just singularly focused on one line of business, that would absolutely be ideal. Another obvious example would be UMG in the portfolio in the music industry. It's just, that relentless focus is, you can go down the line of some of the most successful businesses in history. And there are exceptions, right? Conglomerates, decent, like Berkshire Hathaway being one. Sure. But if you look at, the Costcos of the world, the Microsofts of the world, the Amazons of the world, we've invested in the dollar stores over the years. I think generally that tends to be the case more often than not.
That's interesting. So we talked a little bit about portfolio construction. You said you're global, you're concentrated, you have these three buckets. Can we break it down a little more though? Like, around how many stocks do you own? How do you think about position sizing? Like, maybe what do you consider an average full position size? What does a starter position size look like? And are you typically fully invested, or do you hold some cash?
Sure. So good questions. Would say we generally hold, and I'll again emphasize generally, 10 to 20 names in the portfolio. Mm-hmm. I don't know that there's any scientific rhyme or reason for that. I mean, there is data that shows something like 80% of the benefits of diversification come from holding 10 names. And once you get up to 20 names, you're at 90% of the benefits. So beyond that, I think it's more or less protection from ignorance rather than trying to add value. For us, it's more so, I mean, it's nice to have the science, but just over the years, I've realized that, you know, when we start falling towards that 10 number or below, I start losing sleep. just worrying about concentration risk. And on the flip side, right, once we start climbing towards 20, and you know, we've been up to 25 at times, I start losing sleep because I'm worried that, you know, we're not as close to the businesses that we should be or would like to be. So that being said, you know, even, you know, I think right now we're probably around 18 names in the portfolio. You know, top 10 are probably, you know, 70 to 75% of that exposure. So bulk of exposure is still in the top 10.
Sure.
I think one of the things we probably do different than a number of other business, other managers in the industry, you know, a lot of managers, so we size positions based on probability weighted expected return, and we'll get to that in a moment. But generally, our largest positions are not always the names in the book that have the absolute highest probability weighted return. They're more often the names in the book where we have the lowest perceived downside risk. And that's just, you know, and we can get into risk management down the road, but, you know, we just find that when you can find when we can underwrite a good business at a price where we think it's extremely hard for us to lose money over a multi-year time horizon, you know, just a lot of things can go right and the upside just tends to take care of itself. So rather than, you know, size up on names where the upside might look tremendous, but you know, it might be a binary outcome, or downside might be, you know, substantial. We just prefer not to take that risk. So again, largest positions are generally names where we see the lowest long-term risk of permanent capital loss, complemented with smaller positions around the edges where, you know, the expected returns may be significantly higher. But they may have more asymmetric outcomes. But again, right, because that asymmetry may include a lot of downside volatility, those are never going to be enormous positions. I'd say core positions are generally 5 to 10% of the portfolio. It's rare for us to get up to 15, 20% of the portfolio in a single position, but we have been there a few times over the years. And then smaller names are names we're either, you know, scaling into over time. Sometimes we'll have a basket of names in the portfolio. We've owned several tobacco names at one time or another. We've owned several dollar stores at one time or another. We've owned several airports at one time or another. So we generally think of those in terms of position sizing as a single position.
Sure.
Or they may be, you know, smaller names may also be names that we're either, you know, scaling out of or scaling into, or like I said before, have, you know, extremely asymmetric outcomes.
Yeah. And there's that relentless focus on capital preservation. So let's just dive in a little more into risk management. So you know, you made it clear that your largest positions tend to be the ones that you think have, in general, the least downside. And you've also said that you're long biased. How else do you manage risk in the portfolio? Do you have some hedges in place or some shorts or options in place to manage risk?
Yeah. So, I think risk management comes from a variety of sources, right? First and foremost is, you know, making sure we are not overpaying for any business that we're buying. So it goes back to the classic, you know, margin of safety.
Yep.
So price is the first factor in managing risk. Second factor is, you know, what you're getting to, John, is really just, you know, we call it common sense. You know, I think a lot of portfolio construction today is overly dependent on trying to quantify risk down to a single number or a number of factors also dependent upon a single number. all of those things change over time with different market regimes and different economic environments. And so, you know, we think it really just comes down to common sense, right? Just being thoughtful about the types of businesses we own, making sure that we're not completely leaning over to one side of the boat, loading up the portfolio with a single bet, you know, one way or another, either too defensive or too aggressive.
Sure.
You know, we like to say that, you know, investors don't need Broyhill in a bull market. We tend to lag when markets are going straight up. You know, our outperformance longer term has, you know, more than 100% of it has been generated in down markets. And again, that's because, you know, our number one priority here is protecting capital.
Yep.
Because we manage money for investors that have worked extremely hard, most, if not all of their lives, to build that nest egg. And we want to work just as hard, you know, to keep it. And so what that means is, you know, we're basically operating in a constant state of doubt, because I think doubt keeps us safe. You know, the real world is uncertain. You know, despite what most folks in our industry would like to believe, you know, most of whom are living in an imaginary state of certainty, and despite repeated evidence to the contrary, those very confident opinions in the industry can turn out to be wrong more often than not. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, being wrong seems to have little impact on self-confidence in the industry, which can be a problem because overconfidence, right, is a wonderful thing for self-esteem, but it's a disastrous thing for long-term performance.
Yeah.
It leads to, you know, overly aggressive investing, which we saw a lot of during 20 and 21. Right in that speculative frenzy with all the stimulus money that was thrown into the markets during the pandemic. It means, you know, that aggressive investing can often be confused with genius during bull markets. But, you know, as a lot of investors learned in 2022, holding on to those gains can become particularly challenging when the tide goes out.
Yep.
Yeah, those gains and those types of years are a lot more exciting than, you know, our, you know, more tortoise-like approach to investing. But I think more often than not, you know, it's the investment manager himself or herself that reaps most of the benefits of those spectacular returns in the form of fees. And more often than not, their clients rarely come along for the ride, right? Because as you know, they pile in when times are good and just in time for things to roll over.
Yep.
We don't think good investing is about always trying to earn the highest return we possibly can in a given year. I think the better way to think about it, right? And the way, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. The family office has been around since 1980. I've been sitting in the same seat, at least metaphorically, for 20 years. You know, so we've been around for a while. I think the way you do that is, you know, working hard to achieve pretty good returns that you and your investors can stick with over a very long period of time. That's when compounding works best. And I think, you know, that one statement is probably the most overlooked and underappreciated fact in our business. So it just comes down to, right, like risk management, really a lot of risk management just comes down to, you know, trying to make as much money as we can without sticking our neck out too far. And it's when you kind of stick out your neck when things are looking really hot to stretch for those, right, to stretch for those big winners is when you tend to get into trouble.
Chris, for what it's worth, I agree with everything you just said about risk management, everything. And at one point you said it's a fact that gets looked over the most. And it is a fact. You know, mathematically, pretty good or moderate returns extended over the longest period of time possible is the best way to compound returns over a career.
Yeah.
or over multiple generations if you're talking about family wealth and family office wealth. It's just how compounding works. And it does get looked over because of some of the returns people see over short periods of time, like we did in 2020 and 2021.
Yeah, Absolutely. And it's important to differentiate too, right? So, you know, because we are programmed naturally and just by experience to worry, you know, we're often painted with a more bearish brush than some of the more aggressive, more bullish managers in the field, perhaps. So I think it's important to differentiate, right? Like risk management is not the same as risk avoidance, right? Like if you avoid taking risk altogether, you're also pretty sure to avoid generating returns altogether. Yeah. We just want to make sure we're being paid handsomely, right, for taking the risks that we choose to take.
I agree. And it's just a different way of thinking about portfolio management also. Like I think that managers like yourself and some really good hedge fund managers out there that I've spoken to, they don't think about it as managing a portfolio. They think about it as managing risk. That's actually the language and the terminology they use. I was talking to a portfolio, a legendary, really hedge fund portfolio manager that has stepped back from managing a portfolio. And now he's more of a mentor to people at the firm. And when he told me this, he didn't say, I stepped back from managing the portfolio. He said, I stepped back from managing risk. And that was the language that he used. So it's just fascinating how different people have different views on chasing returns versus managing risk. So I just really appreciate this conversation that we just had. So you mentioned you're a boutique firm. How many people are on the investing team, and are you generalists or sector specialists?
Yeah, so we're still building. We actually will be announcing a new addition to the team, hopefully as early as next week.
Right.
Right. So we opened up the new office in Charlotte about a year and a half ago. At that time, the investment team was myself and our director of research, who I've known for about as long as I've been in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. We hired a third analyst around the time that we opened the office in Charlotte, and we're just about to add another. So, you know, by the time this podcast goes public, I think it's safe to say that the investment team is myself and three analysts. So we're a team of four, and just by definition, being a boutique, being a small firm, wanting to keep it small, I mean, that almost by definition means we're all generalists. Mm-hmm. Now we tend to, right, like, so everyone on the team tends to gravitate towards situations that interest them most, or where they've got experience or things that they've worked on in the past. For example, our director of research has a background in healthcare, PhD in organic chemistry, has worked in big pharma, has worked in a number of clinical labs. Generally, anything healthcare related in the portfolio, she's taking the lead on. Mm-hmm. We've got another analyst on the team that tends to gravitate towards special situations. You know, we're not, you know, by no means are we a merger arb fund, but, you know, we do get excited when we can underwrite a merger arb type situation, even without the deal. Yeah. And so, you know, those types of positions will tend to be our largest, although unfortunately they're few and far between when we find something like that. But we've got, you know, one analyst on the team in particular that loves sort of going through merger arb and legal docs and just, you know, scouring that universe. And I tend to be a floater. I don't know that I've got a particular focus. I don't know that I've had a particular focus at any point in my life. It's just, you know, we're all kind of just led by curiosity and, you know, just turning over as many rocks as possible.
So with turning over a lot of rocks, how many stocks do you expect yourself and the three analysts, to cover? Like, how many stocks do you think they should be able to cover, you know, thoroughly and rigorously?
I mean, I think it goes back to the number of names in the portfolio, right? So, yeah, the team has grown a bit over the last couple of years. We've gone from two or three to three or four. So you know, in theory, you could say maybe the number of names in the portfolio should expand over time. I don't know that that's the direction we want to go in. So my comfort level, I'm most comfortable with 10 to 20 names. Maybe that'll expand over the years as the team grows, but I don't envision the team growing much beyond where we are today. Given that it's been 20 years and I've been comfortable with that 10 to 20, I think it's, you know, unlikely that the next 20 years it's going to be substantially different than that.
Right.
I would say, you know, it would be nice. There are a lot of firms that say, you know, this is our particular universe, right? We just invest in healthcare stocks in the US, or we just invest in the highest quality businesses in the world. That has always appealed to me in theory, right? To be able to say, okay, we know these 100 or 500 companies better than anyone else in the world. I'm just not programmed to think that way, right? Like I like having the flexibility and having a mandate to be able to go anywhere and look at what interests us. There's a lot of, the danger there is getting out over your skis or getting into situations where, you know, the person on the other side of that trade knows the business and knows the situation better than you do. I think, you know, how we protect ourselves there is just, you know, being honest and having humility about what we know and what we don't know. And just, you know, making sure that we're sticking in that circle of competence, but still trying to expand that circle year after year and really day after day. So I don't know that there's, you know, I don't know that I've got a good answer for the number of names that I think, you know, we should be able to handle. I do have a good answer day to day when it feels like we're too scattered and we need to, you know, refocus our attention. And, you know, we spend a lot of time with the team sort of reviewing the pipeline, prioritizing our workflow, prioritizing, you know, what we're looking at in terms of names in the portfolio, different situations. And that's just, you know, making sure there's just constant communication in terms of, you know, making sure we're always working on the most important thing at the time.
Definitely. What does portfolio turnover look like? And the reason I ask is, are you looking to add new ideas to the portfolio every year?
I would say you could probably back into that, right? Just based on the number of holdings, average and our average holding period, right? So assuming 10 to 20 names and a 3 to 5 year holding period, which is about typical for us. Sure. You know, that implies 20 to 30% turnover annually. Mm-hmm. I think historically, longer term in the amount of time that I've been at Broy Hill, turnover has probably been a good bit lower than that, but you know, it's as good a place as any to start. So I would say, you know, if you've run the numbers on 10 to 20 names with 20, 30% turnover, at the low end, that implies we need about 2 investments a year. At the high end, we're around 6. So if you split the difference, you know, we're getting to about 1 a quarter, which feels about right. Mm-hmm. I think, again, some of that is just personal preference, right? So there's a number of smart investors that say, you know, the right holding period for a stock is forever, and they're never sellers of a business. I think I would get incredibly bored if we had zero turnover in the portfolio. Mm-hmm. Right? It's fun looking at new things. It's that curiosity, right? The excitement when you're going down a path and you're finding something new, and you know, more often than not, it turns into nothing. But you know, I think it's important to maintain and try to build that level of excitement, enthusiasm across the team and across the book. And so, you know, having some fresh names in the book, I think is the best way to do that, or at least it's the best way to do it for us. We've had years where we've had, you know, little to zero turnover. And then we've had years like last year, particularly in the fourth quarter, like we just had this flurry of activity. And now I'd imagine we'd be quiet for some time.
Earlier in the show, you heard us talk about the investing platform public.com. That's where you can trade options with no commissions or per contract fees. And you get a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. NerdWallet recently gave Public 5 out of 5 stars for options trading. If you want to see why, go to public.com and start getting a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. Paid for by Public Investing, options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description, U.S. members only. FinChat.io is the complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. They have all the standard financial data on more than 100,000 stocks globally. But beyond that, they have company-specific segment and KPI data on more than 1,500 stocks. Want to see Netflix's average revenue per member over the last 10 years? FinChat's got it. Like to track YouTube's advertising? They've got that too. Want to see how much of Celsius's revenue comes from Costco? You guessed it, they've got it. Want to see Home Depot's average ticket price or sales per square foot? FinChat's got you covered. The breadth of FinChat's segment and KPI data is truly one of a kind. I use FinChat and love it for the KPIs I can't easily find anywhere else, the awesome screener, and the quick and easy charting tool. To get 15% off any paid plan, go to finchat.io/JRO. That is finchat.io/JRO to get 15% off any paid plan today. The link will be in the show notes.
So you talked about you're all generalists, but you know, some of the team members gravitate a little more to sectors and industries that they're more comfortable with, like maybe healthcare or maybe some special situations. But outside of that, how do you generally approach idea generation? Is it just from reading? Is it talking to a network of other investors that you respect and admire? Are you running screens? How are y'all now narrowing down your investing universe?
Yeah, I think this is the fun part of the job, at least for me, and where where creativity plays a big role. I gave a presentation in London a few weeks ago where we talked through some of this and gave specific examples in terms of like real time, how we've walked through that process. Mm-hmm. I started off with, there's a quote from John Cleese, who's the co-founder of Monty Python, where he gets, where good ideas come from. Yeah. And his response was, we don't know where they come from. What we do know is that we don't get them from our laptops, right? And I think what he's trying to say there is, right, like it's so easy to just, especially sitting in this seat, to get trapped and just lured into staring at blinking prices all day and staring at our screens and responding and reacting to every piece of news that comes across the desk. But the reality is, like, the only way to really see and think differently about things is to make sure that you are getting distance. Mm-hmm. And that only happens when you can relax and really let your mind wander. I think that, another great quote along those lines, is from Kahneman's partner, Amos Tversky, who said, "The secret to doing good research is always to be a little underemployed. You waste years by not being able to waste hours." Right. And so there's this, and I feel it too. Like, we've got this constant push to be more productive and more efficient with our team, all the time and everything we do. The reality is there's no silver bullet. And a lot of times, to let an idea surface, you just need to step back and leave it alone. And so, we view our job in terms of idea generation is, basically to surround ourselves with as many ideas as possible, as long as possible, right? So to answer your question directly, that means talking with other investors, right? Talking to business owners, reading widely, reading broadly, reading filings, reading newspapers, reading transcripts, doing calls ourselves. Most of the time we want to be just taking in all that information, but then, you also need to carve out time to just step back and slow down enough to recognize when there's a good idea in front of you.
Yes.
Right. So again, it goes back to, right, you know, turning over a lot of rocks. And to give you, you know, to give you a concrete example, you know, last year, you know, I'm sure it won't be a surprise to you, or, you know, and you and your listeners are probably somewhat familiar with the, these, you know, slightly, you know, increasingly popular weight loss drugs in the U.S., right?
Yep, absolutely.
You know, probably second only to AI in terms right. of the, you know, the enthusiasm and the impact that, 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 that development had on markets. You know, we were following that like everyone else for months and months and months and months, you know, looking at, you know, just looking at the headlines, looking at all the forecasts for, you know, the degree that, you know, sales for those drugs over the next decade, all the, you know, you can see the, you know, number of references on earnings transcripts was going through the roof in like Q2 and Q3 of last year. It was almost every call you were on, no matter the industry, you know, analysts were asking questions about GLP-1.
Right.
And so, you know, that's a good example where, you know, in the heat of the moment, you're just kind of, you're just watching all of this come across, right? Day after day, week after week, month after month. And then it just, you know, I don't know that there was any one particular thing we can point to, but over a period of weeks in the fall, I just said, okay, I think it's time. We need to sit down and look at, you know, where the biggest dislocations are in the market around this, because the hype here has just gotten so extreme. There has to be disconnect somewhere. So let's just spend, let's put our head down. Yeah. Let's step back and really think through this and then sort of put our heads down for the next week or two and start drilling down into right where we want to focus.
I love that. I love that. So maybe walk us through like what the research process looks like on your team. So from, you know, from the day one of your analysts starts researching a new idea, to the day you make a decision to, you know, add it or not add it to the portfolio, like what steps are taken in that research process and what does it look like?
Yeah. I wish, and my analysts on the team would probably wish as well, that there was a well-defined, structured process and or checklist, right? Mm-hmm. That we can just go from start to finish, from idea to position. You know, and if you looked at a number of investor presentations, you know, I think most of them probably give you the impression that it looks like that, right? Like everybody's got these really neat diagrams that illustrate their investment process. It looks extremely orderly and formulaic. You know, we haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah.
We think it's, you know, we think in the process itself, you know, can be structured and should be methodical, but it's never been mechanical for us. Mm-hmm. And I just think, right, creative processes in themselves are rarely orderly or formulaic. You know, they don't follow a straight line from point A to point B. And that's just because creative thought doesn't follow a straight line. Mm-hmm. Right. So that means idea generation is organic. You know, thinking back to the example we just discussed, you know, we need to know that first and foremost, good ideas can come from anywhere. So we always need to be tuned in. And then to answer your question, right. So once we tune in, and find something, you know, it's time to dig out. So we go from idea generation to, you know, what we call our first look to what we call a deep dive. Mm-hmm. So we'll start with the first look. You know, that's essentially once we've identified what we think is a good idea, right? We take a step back and prioritize the workflow. The goal there, right, is like we want to root out as many ideas as possible, as quickly as possible. So that we're just focusing, right, the majority of our time on a handful of ideas that we think have the best odds of making it into the portfolio, right? Because at the end of the day, that's ultimately what we're trying to do. Yeah. Either putting fresh cash to work, or we're looking for things that have a better expected payoff, expected risk reward than existing names in the portfolio. So the first look is when we come up to speed as quickly as possible, depending upon our existing knowledge base, prior experience. It could be a day, it could be a week. We try to prioritize opportunities that look like they've got the best risk-adjusted return. And to do that, we kind of start with some basic questions, right? So this is the part that might start to resemble a template, right? So Can we explain how the business and how the industry operates to a fifth grader, right? Is it within our circle of competence? If it's not in our circle of competence, right? Who do we know in our network that we can tap into to better understand the business and the industry? And is the opportunity large enough or the returns great enough to warrant spending time, any more time on the business? And in addition to that, the other caveat there is is there anyone on the team that really wants to spend time on it? Right. Cause if it's a business that it looks like it's super interesting, but nobody on the team really wants to spend time researching that particular industry or that particular company. You've got to have some level of enthusiasm to get started, right? So oftentimes if there's just not enthusiasm for it, we'll just pass, we'll just put it aside for something that we're more excited about. And then from there, it's, can we identify the three or four, right? Key drivers for the business and the investment thesis. There's literally, hundreds of things that may go into those two or three or four drivers, but really most investments, we want to know, really even better than three or four, we'd one or two levers that these are the things we have to get right. Yep. And so then the question is, do we think we can develop an informed view of those things? What don't we know and how can we learn it? And then finally, can we get a sense for where we might be wrong, right? Or how we might be wrong? And can we get comfortable with the consequences of being wrong? And so those are really, what we're trying, that's really just the basics of what we're trying to get to when we take a first look at a business. Again, sometimes we can do that in a day or two, sometimes it's a week or two. Every one of those questions isn't relevant to every situation. Some situations have different questions that are more relevant. But it's just, the process overall, we're just trying to get to, is the investment a good fit for us and for the portfolio? And do we want to spend significantly more time, right, on the business to understand it? If we get there, right, then it's, everything else gets put on the back burner. Someone on the team takes the lead, rolls up their sleeves, and then we jump into our deep dive. And that's really when we're formalizing the thesis, and going about determining a range of outcomes for the business, right? So this is, doing everything from, reading through years of historical financials, transcripts, SEC filings, expert network calls, annual reports, proxies, industry analysis, competitor analysis, and then having conversations with peers, right? So best case scenario is, it's a situation where we know who's on the other side of the trade and can have a conversation with folks that are short the stock. Right. Cause you want to understand, and realistically we want to understand that viewpoint better than our own. Yeah. So this could take days, weeks, months, just again, depending upon the business, how deep we want to get, and the opportunity set. Then again, we try to eliminate, right, everything but the essentials, right? So we've spent a lot of time just aggregating data and formulating a view. And then the tough part is really just narrowing that down to really just what are the two or three most important variables here. I'd say when you do that, you know, most of what we look at just gets rejected along the way. Mm-hmm. Some of it is just because it's new, right? So like you have to recognize that selling something. So generally, if we're, you know, I mentioned we hold generally for 3 to 5 years. Like if we've held a business for 5 years, we know that business incredibly well.
Sure.
Right. We likely know the management team incredibly well. We likely know how they're competing in the industry very well. And it's just, you know, years and years and years of following the company, following results, following the business, following the industry, to trade out of that for something that looks like it might potentially be more attractive or offer a higher expected return, right? Like, and if it's a newer investment where we've got less experience, like there's some risk there, right?
Yes.
So like,
yes.
If it's, you know, it's real easy to kind of just jump at the shiny new thing, but more often than not, after we've done that degree of work on a business, the answer is, yeah, this is super interesting. Let's just watch it for a while, right? Because we want to start to get to know the business, know the management team. And really that just doesn't come, you know, you could spend 16 hours a day for a week or two, right? Studying every aspect of a business, but it's not the same as following it for years and years. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so more often than not, the result of this is not a new position. It's just, you know, we really like this business, but I do want to, you know, I still feel like I need to be closer to it. And that's just going to take time. Now there's exceptions, right? But like, I would say that's more often than not. In terms of valuation in the process, you know, we're not spending a whole lot of time, if any time, forecasting quarterly earnings. Mm-hmm. We're thinking more about longer term normalized earnings power, 3, 5, 7 years out. And again, that also coincides with our holding period, right? So if we're looking at, you know, trying to forecast what the business would earn in a normal operating environment, you know, whatever normal means for that business, you know, we assume that it's normalizing over 3 to 5 years. You know, if the business normalizes over 3 to 5 years and the valuation normalizes over 3 to 5 years, then we should have done very well over that time period. And we can move on. So again, you know, the valuation itself is never exact. It's an imprecise science. And so we're trying to come at that from a number of different angles as well. Right. We're trying to triangulate. You know, there's no, I don't think there's one correct way to value a business. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we're not a great fan of DCFs just because I think you can make a DCF say whatever you want.
Yep.
I think, you know, similar to, you know, when you're researching anything, we try to find as many data points and as many different data points as possible that kind of all point to the same direction. Yeah. And valuation is sort of the same way, right? Like we can look at private market values for a business. We can look at, you know, historical transaction, you know, transactions for the business, right? Those two data points right there, right, tell you what an actual buyer, an operator, right, someone in the industry is willing to pay for the entire business. That's about as good as a data point you can get. You know, we will look, you know, we'll do, you know, I prefer actually doing like a reverse DCF rather than a DCF. And doing a reverse DCF just makes the analysis a whole lot simpler, right? You look at the current price, you back into what the current price implies for, you know, long-term revenue growth or long-term normalized margins. And then you can just say, and you can just make a decision, right? If you want to take the over or under. And sometimes, right, like you do that and it's not real clear, right? If you want to take the over and under, and that probably means that it's probably close to fair value. There's other times when you do it and you're like, this makes absolute no sense. And so you don't necessarily have to know the exact number to know that the current number is wrong. If that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And, trying to estimate normalized earnings power 3 to 5 years out within a reasonable range. I mean, you're speaking my love language there, honestly. And then, yeah. And then, supporting that with buyout multiples, which is what you just said, especially recent buyout multiples of, competitors in a similar industry. I also agree that's about as precise as you can get at that moment in time for what smart private market buyers are willing to pay for a similar business. And so, yeah, I agree with all of that. Let me just ask you a quick follow-up. What multiples do you typically pay for some of the stocks? Are you typically at above average, multiples or below average PEs? What are you typically paying?
Yeah, good question. I don't know that there's a typical John, right? Like I started out by saying, value investing means different things to different people. To us, right, value investing means we want to buy mispriced assets. And so the multiple that represents, a mispriced asset is going to be different depending upon the asset itself. And so, probably, and so, we're not, I think, value has gotten this bad rep and has become a bad word over the last 15 years in the industry. And I think, most people, when they think of value investors, they think, we're just buying low PE stocks or low price to book stocks and just all the traditional statistical definitions of value. I think most of us know that that's overly simplified. But again, and maybe the best way to answer that is with a couple questions, right? So like in, I'll give you two examples, two very different examples in the portfolio. So in 2022, I guess it was actually our year-end 21 letter, right? Along with that letter, we wrote up our investment thesis and what's still a top position in the portfolio in Fiserv, the payments company. Right. At the time, we didn't think Fiserv could grow anywhere near as fast as some of the, fintech darlings that were putting up like eye-popping numbers. But we did think that organic growth at the company would come, would come in well ahead of the market for several years. We did think the company would generate real profits and real cash flow. At the time, right, like you had companies like PayPal trading at 30 times earnings, companies like Square and Adyen trading in more like 50 times earnings. We were buying Fiserv for probably around 14 times earnings, at which was about a standard deviation below the company's 5-year average multiple, and it was about 3/4 of a market multiple. So we were paying 14 times earnings for a company that we thought would generate high single-digit revenue growth, driving, 15% to 20% earnings per share growth for the next several years. We thought that the company might do $8 to $10 in free cash flow per share within a few years, which on our numbers would imply a 50% to 100% gain in the stock if it just returned to the low end of its historical valuation. Fast forward to today, consensus for 24 and 25 is at 860 and $10 of earnings respectively,
Wow.
which would put the stock back at about 18 times earnings. So we still own it. It's still a top position. And it's still trading at a, and that 18 times earnings is cheaper than we paid for it, right? But it's still close to a 20% discount to where the market's trading today. So that's one example. The other one I would say, which, similar setup, largest position in the portfolio today is Philip Morris. It's super interesting to me to look at how much sentiment around a business that really hasn't changed at all, right? how much sentiment can push multiples, right? Like, and you know, Meta is probably the most extreme, which we owned also, right? Like coming out of 22, I think Meta was trading at like a single digit multiple of operating profit, right? And that multiple, I think, was, you know, 3x last year. And the business didn't change, right? It's just, you know, it was just purely sentiment. Similarly, if you look at Philip Morris and look at tobacco, right? Like prior to the surge in alternatives to combustible cigarettes, the sector traded at a premium to the market. Philip Morris traded at a 20 to 30% premium to the S&P. Once Juul exploded in the US and combustible tobacco volumes, you know, the decline accelerated as people took on vaping, Philip Morris valuation was basically cut in half, and was trading at 12 times earnings, which was basically a 40% discount to the market at the lows. That's just incredibly cheap for a company of this caliber. We'd argue the company today, like, and I mean, that's a good point too, right? So historical valuations are helpful only to the extent that, right, the economics of the business are consistent over that time period. Right. So looking at, you know, where a stock is traded historically doesn't tell you much if it's a completely different business today than it was 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
In this case, I would argue Philip Morris is perhaps better positioned today than at any time in its past, considering the lead it has in, you know, fast growing, actually higher margin than traditional tobacco, reduced risk products. So we think PM can also generate $8 to $10 of earnings over the next few years. And I just think, right, the way we think about it is a company generating mid-high single-digit revenue growth with, you know, close to zero cyclicality, right? There's right, very little economic sensitivity in the business, expanding margins, throwing off a ton of cash flow. Like, I think that business should trade at least at a market multiple.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you work through that math, you know, you get to a pretty nice expected return on that business over the long term. And that's before you even, you know, before you even throw in the dividend, which is approaching 6% annually. So we've owned, you know, we've got businesses in the portfolio that, you know, it might appear, if you just look at the multiple of the trailing or forward earnings, you know, they might appear expensive to a traditional value investor. We've got other investor, you know, we've got other businesses in the portfolio that, you know, probably fit more closely to a traditional value investor portfolio. But yeah, I don't know that there's a multiple that we're looking for. It just, you know, depends on the situation, depends on the business.
I think this is my 9th or 10th episode that I'm going to release on the J-Row show. And that was, I think, the most color and detail any of my guests has given regarding how they think about these multiples and everything that goes into that. Just with, you know, just with your example with Pfizer, you know, you said it was trading at a standard deviation below its 5-year historical average, but then it was also at, you know, trading, I think it was 3/4 of the market multiple. And so, you know, you went through multiple different lenses of what that PE was and could be. And I'll just quickly mention with regard to Pfizer as well, when I was at the Motley Fool, I'm no longer there, but we put out a piece on stocks that we believed met Warren Buffett's criteria. And what I mean by that is in November of 2022, Chris, Todd mm-hmm. Todd Combs did a, you're probably familiar with this, but he did a breakfast interview with Michael Mobison at Columbia Business School and revealed to Michael that every Saturday or most Saturdays, Todd Combs will go over to Warren Buffett's house and he mentioned the three basically criteria Warren asked him to think about. And Warren asked Todd to think about the S&P 500. And then the three criteria are stocks that they think are trading at 15 times forward or less. Businesses that they think earnings, they have a 90% conviction earnings will be higher 5 years down the road. Doesn't matter how much higher, just higher. And then a 50% confidence and conviction that earnings per share can compound by at least 7% over the next 5 years. And so we put out a piece, and I put it out, and I put Pfizer into that. And the reason was because at the time, and I know you know this, but Pfizer has grown its adjusted earnings per share. At the time, I think it was 37 consecutive years.
Yeah.
And now it's 39 consecutive years. And so if, and it was trading at 15 times. You mentioned you wrote it up at 14 times. And when I wrote it up, it was trading at 15 times. And so, but that's why I had a 90%, I mean, not the only reason, but that's one of the reasons I had a 90% confidence that earnings would be higher in 5 years, because they have been higher every year for the last 39. And it was just this really, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'll have to dig up that interview. It sounds interesting. I missed that one, John.
So that was actually a write up that I did for the Motley Fool.
No, what's the Mobison?
Oh yeah. I can send you the link on that. Yeah. Very, very interesting, because you know Todd Combs, that's a pretty big revelation, I think, on the discussions that he's having with Warren Buffett. And then just the last thing I'll say about Pfizer, as you also know, is they have this fintech company inside of it called Clover. That's actually pretty good. And so it's just an interesting company.
Well, and Clover, like when we wrote it up, like, that was part of our analysis. And we, you know, just to, you know, if you wanted to get a little bit silly, and I think we said something similar in the past about PM, coincidentally, is using both of those examples. But like Clover was growing faster than Square inside of Pfizer. And so, you know, if you wanted to, like you could do and you knew the gross payment volume, right, at Clover and how much revenues they were generating there. And so you could value Clover like a fintech inside of Pfizer. And if you did that, right, the core business was trading at ridiculously low multiples.
Right. Yeah.
We did the same analogy with Philip Morris and, right, like looking at, if you look at the growth rate and the margins on their reduced risk products, and then look at like what people were paying for like these marijuana stocks, for example, when they were at the peak. I don't know why you'd ever pay for any of those when you could own something like Philip Morris. It's you know, the silliness that we see across markets. I don't know how we're still having the argument whether or not markets are efficient.
That's true. Yeah, that is very, very true. Anyway, I want to say I really appreciate the color you gave around valuation there. How much time do you spend thinking about the macro backdrop, and do you have a current macro or market outlook that you currently hold with high conviction?
Yeah, I think the best way to think about that is, you know, we say that philosophically, right, we want to invest bottom up, but worry top down. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of value investors mistakenly just write off macroeconomic analysis. I think, and we believe that, you know, monitoring global imbalances and potential stress points across the economy, I don't think you can, you know, manage risk or say you manage risk without having a feel for or a pulse of what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference is, right, like it's impossible to predict, you know, where we're going, but, you know, we can know and we can understand and we should know where we are. Right. And so it's not necessarily mandatory to be able to predict what's going to happen in the future. But you can recognize like when preconditions are in place for bad things to happen. right? When sentiment is looking, you know, completely stretched and overly optimistic, like we saw again, mentioned, you know, the most recent episode, 2021, when, you know, markets broadly are looking wildly overvalued, or when there's instability in the world and markets are just, you know, refusing to pay attention to it or just ignoring it, right? Like sometimes markets react to headlines, or probably more often than not, markets react to headlines more so than they should. But there's also times where markets just completely ignore what's going on in the world or the reality on the ground and just keep levitating. Yep. And so, you know, going back to one of your questions, I think I failed to answer earlier. So like we will try to, so we don't short stocks, but we will look for creative hedges, and creative slash misprice hedges when we can find them, and when they can offer us some sort of asymmetry. I think, right, like the those extreme imbalances like don't happen often, but when they do, like they can have a tremendous impact on asset prices and fundamentals. So just ignoring them does not make sense to us. Yeah. You know, I said at the beginning, right, like our job, like I'm a worrywart. Our job as a whole, is to worry. And that's because, right, we're programmed to preserve capital, because we believe that, you know, the key to compounding long-term wealth is avoiding short-term losses. You know, being, you know, I'll describe myself as a professional worrier, and you know, this is coming back to, you know, do we have a view? Sure. Like to me, markets look incredibly expensive today, and particularly US markets. I'll caveat that with saying that, like, at the same time, there's tremendous pockets of value within the US and across the globe, not dissimilar to what we saw in the late 90s and early 2000s when you had just a narrowing segment of the market that was getting more and more expensive by the day, and everything else was getting left behind. And so, you know, I think I said earlier that, you know, being a professional worrier means that, you know, we're often painted with a bearish brush. You know, if you went back, John, you mentioned you've been, you know, reading our letters for a while, like, mm-hmm. yeah, you can probably count on one hand, or yeah, probably a better analogy. I was talking to a potential investor recently, and he made the comment about, you know, listen, we're, you know, I'm very worried about the market. I think we're setting up for another really big correction. We want to invest. We're going to invest with you, but wouldn't I just be better to wait for that to happen? And my response to him was, listen, I don't disagree with you, right? Like, I think we probably are setting up for a big correction. We probably are setting up for, right? Like if you and I were having this conversation 5-10 years from now, John, I wouldn't be surprised if the S&P was in the same place.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can have that view and we could still make a lot of money between now and then.
Absolutely.
Right. And so it's like, and my comment to him was, you know, we're a much better value investor. We're much better stock pickers than we are market timers. Right. Like if he asked me that question at any point in the last 10 years, I can probably count on one hand how many times I would have said, no, this is it. You need to plow into the market. Give us everything you have right now. Right. Like I can literally count on one hand in the times that I've been at Broyhill where I just said, you know, we just want to be all in, give it all to us. We're going to put it all into the market. We are uber bullish on markets right now. We think valuations are pointing to, you know, 15-20% long-term returns. It's probably a handful of times that I would have said that and come out and said that publicly, which means the rest of the time, like we were probably overly cautious, but you know, we don't let the fact that we're worriers by nature and, you know, might be seen as overly bearish. We don't let that impact, you know, what we're buying in the portfolio necessarily, right? Because the reality is over that time, yeah, we were worried most of that time, but we've still managed to outperform over the last decade plus. in a market that's gone straight up, right? So obviously, like, our cautiousness and concerns on the overall market don't prohibit us from making money. I think they just, I think they just help us do what we said at the outset, and that's just, trying not to stick our neck out too far.
Yeah, you said, I agree with everything you said. Again, you said that value investors sometimes get painted with a bearish brush. You know, I think sometimes we get painted even uglier than that. Like, sometimes people say, optimists win in the end, and that's true. You know, markets go up over time, and they historically go up 3 out of every 4 years on average historically. But being a worrier or being risk averse does not mean that we want markets to crash or that we're bad people. It just means we're cognizant of risks. And, like you mentioned, where we are in the current cycle. Maybe we do things on the edges of our portfolio. Maybe it's raise cash. Maybe it's put some more hedges in place when the pricing makes sense. Whatever it is, it doesn't mean that we want markets to go down or that we're perma bears or that we can't perform. That's the other thing is that, I think some people assume that all value investors have underperformed for the last decade, which is also just completely untrue. I agree with you on that as well.
I mean, I think it helps to think in terms of, right, like, you can be optimistic that your house is not going to catch on fire, right? But you're not going to live without home insurance.
Exactly.
And that home insurance, right, is just, it's a drag on your earnings otherwise, but you're happy to pay it because you need it. Yeah. And so I think we tend to think the same way about the portfolio, which is, I think somewhat rare.
I would agree with that. Talk to us about selling. So you mentioned that you typically hold stocks for 3 to 5 years, but under what circumstances do you trim a position and under what circumstances do you sell out completely?
Yeah, so we just wrote about this in our year-end letter because we had so much activity in the fourth quarter, and some of that, a good chunk of that, were sales. Mm-hmm. And I bucketed them into three different groups. So the first reason to sell is the best reason. And it's when, our thesis is fully played out and or, right, the security has approached our estimate of intrinsic value. That's often the hardest time to sell because it means you're selling winners, right? And I'll try not to go on a long tangent about, right, selling winners and watering the weeds, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Like most value investors, we have probably historically sold too early. But again, some of that is just, clearing out sort of stale names in the book and making rooms for new ideas. But that's the best case scenario is, you put a position on, it worked, you move on to something else. Second best option would be you find something better, right? So you're fully invested, and you've got a full pipeline and you've got a great new idea in the portfolio. And so it's, we need to make room for something. So we're kicking out something that's got the lowest probability weighted expected return and replacing it with something with a much higher probability weighted expected return. Yeah. I would say there's, and that bucket, so that's one example, right? Where you're trimming or liquidating an investment, because you've got a better use of your internal capital. The other way to think about that though is, internal capital could mean the actual capital you have at risk in the market. We also think about it in terms of intellectual capital. Mm-hmm. Which is equally scarce and equally essential to successful investing, right? Like, as value investors, we come into the office day after day, repeatedly being told by the market that we're wrong, right? Like, we're glutton for punishment. We're buying things with a lot of hair on it. We're buying things that other people are selling. It's not a real pleasurable existence a lot of times. Right. But you know, we think it's necessary for long-term performance. But and so it's also necessary to be able to hold on and have the confidence that you're right and the market's wrong, and it's just eventually the market's going to come around to your view. But sometimes the market doesn't come around. And sometimes you're sitting on a position for a number of years and you know you still think it's mispriced. But at least for us, I think sometimes it's healthier to cut those and just bring some fresh blood in the portfolio, right? Because there's only so much punishment you can take. Eventually, if you come in every day and it's just, you know, those, you've got a couple positions and hopefully they've gotten smaller over time because they haven't worked, but you're coming in day after day after day and they're just eating up so much mental bandwidth that it's not healthy. And that mental bandwidth is probably, right, there comes a point in time where that mental bandwidth is better allocated somewhere else. And so we will sell when we've got a better use of our capital, that's either monetary capital or intellectual capital. And then the third bucket is just, you know, we were wrong. And that's hard to do as well, because often that means the stock's fallen a lot. And it's very easy to get into the argument that, well, price has fallen a lot, but right, and the valuation has come down, but price to value gap is still as wide as it was, so we should hold on. You know, more often than not, when a stock moves to that degree, you know, you should be doing one of two things. You should be buying more or you should be selling. It's rarely the case that you should just hold steady. Yeah. But that's the third time is, you know, when, you know, when we realize we're wrong, when we realize there was a hole in our thesis, or when something changes, or, you know, maybe management moves in a completely different direction or makes a, you know, bumbles an acquisition, we will move on.
So earlier in the conversation, you said one of the critical things for you and your team are to distance yourself from some of the noise and some of the screen time. And so my question is, how amazing are the Blue Ridge Mountains?
Great question. Yeah. It's funny. So I grew up in the Northeast. You know, why some Italian kid from New Jersey was a good fit for this, you know, old Southern, you know, furniture family in North Carolina I'm still trying to figure out.
Yeah.
I did not even realize that there were mountains in North Carolina before I moved here. I grew up as a, you know, beach kid. But I have to say, as I've gotten old, and some of it may just be getting older where I don't enjoy the heat as much as I used to, but like I'll take the mountains over the beach anytime these days. Yeah. The other thing that came along with this, and this might go against everything I said in terms of risk management, but, you know, first time I moved down, the first time I went up to the Blue Ridge Mountains and rode along the Blue Ridge Parkway, I decided like on the spot, I need to learn how to ride a motorcycle. Okay. And so the Blue Ridge Parkway might be one of the best roads in the U.S. For doing that. And, you know, contrary to, I think, what would be, you know, conventional intuition, particularly if you've never ridden, I find it incredibly meditative, right? It's just because you absolutely have to be focused on what you're doing and not thinking of anything else. And you're just completely in the zone, tuned in. You can feel the, you know, weather and climate's changing as you're going around bends in the road. And it's just, it's, yeah, the Blue Ridge Mountains are a very special place.
Yeah. I have not ridden a motorcycle yet. And I think I knew North Carolina had pretty mountains, but I didn't know until about 3 or 4 years ago. My friend and his wife are building a vacation home in Blowing Rock. And yeah, he sent a photo. So they're building it from scratch. He sent a photo of, so they had framed the house. So it had just had a wood floor, some framed walls, and an open roof, because they just started framing it. But he sent a picture of him and his wife having a picnic on the floor of the house they were building overlooking the Blue Ridge Mountains. And it's one of the most beautiful photos I've ever seen in my life.
Well, so, if you ever get to visit him, Glowing Rock is about probably under 20 minutes from, well, our office is in Charlotte now, but the family office where I was until 2019 is in Lenoir, North Carolina. And it's literally the, you know, if you just continue up the road from the office, you're in Glowing Rock in 15 minutes.
Awesome. How do you spend the quiet time in your office and what are you reading?
Good question. So quiet time. We didn't get into my background at all, but you know, prior to my life in finance, I actually studied architecture in school.
Oh, nice.
And so I have, at least in my home office, surrounded by Lego architecture sets.
Very cool.
And I just find, you know, both, you know, building with Lego, building with your hands, and even, you know, even just simple as, you know, having puzzles around. Just incredibly relaxing. You know, you're using a different part of the brain. You're turning off the, you know, the left brain and using more right brain thinking. So that's definitely a favorite tool for getting away. In addition to the Blue Ridge Parkway. Also just, I think walks are key. There's just so much research about walking and even more so walking in nature. And what that does for creative thinking and making connections, et cetera. So when we can, you know, if we've got a meeting internally or myself and just one or two other members of the team are huddling on something, I'll often suggest we just walk and talk,
nice.
Rather than sit in the conference room. Mm-hmm. In terms of reading, so I'm sure, John, if you follow us, you're familiar with the book club we do every year. Do you want to talk books or do you want to talk more industry rags and more investment related content?
You can take it however you want. I was thinking more like what newspapers or journals or, you know, sell side research do you find yourself reading more of? But please take it wherever you want.
Yeah. Well, we'll start with the investment stuff because that's probably of most interest to your audience. I'd say, first of all, I still enjoy, you can throw the boomer comment out, but I still just prefer having a physical paper. That goes for hardcover books as well. Mm-hmm. So still, you know, journal still comes to the office every day, FT, Economist, just all the usual suspects. A number of industry journals. We read sell side stuff. Oftentimes I find like initiations of coverage helpful to come up to speed on something in addition to TIGA's expert network transcripts. So one of my favorite things to do is, I will go, if we're coming up to speed on a company, go into TIGA's. I will print out or pull down a PDF of every transcript they've got on the business going back as far as I can, combine it into one ridiculously large PDF that's 500 to 1,000 pages, and then just head to the library or coffee shop for a day and just read it cover to cover.
Wow.
That's just right. There's just not, I don't think there's a substitute for that. You could also like it, you could shortcut it now. In that, you know, you can pull up the PDF in Edge and talk to it with Copilot, right? Or talk to it at ChatGPT and ask specific questions of the document and ask it to pull out trends, et cetera. But it's kind of like, you know, I still feel like it's kind of the equivalent of like reading the cliff notes on a book versus reading the actual book. Or I was having a conversation with a friend just last week or the week before, or using like Blinkist or one of these other services that give you book summaries. It's just like, those are good for talking points at a cocktail party, but you're not going to have the understanding or the appreciation, right, for the subject matter, as if you read the entire thing. And I feel like, you know, reading transcripts, reading annual filings, reading proxies year to year, like, I just don't think there's a substitute. And so, yeah, we read a lot. I also like, you know, even more so than the stuff that our industry puts out is I like reading various industry publications and industry rags for the stuff that's related in the portfolio. Okay. So, for example, I mentioned music industry before, you know, examples would be Billboard, Rolling Stone, Music Week, Music Business Worldwide, right? We read auto news for the auto sector. Healthcare sector has been an area of focus for the last 6 months or so. And from there, you get kind of really deep in the weeds quickly. So like recent subscriptions there, Becker's Hospital Review, Modern Healthcare, Fierce Pharma, Fierce Biotech, MedTech, you know, Dive, Renal and Urology News, Dialysis and Transplantation, Genetic Engineering, Bioprocess International. Like, they do not sound exciting to folks outside of the healthcare industry, but like to really get a sense for, you know, how the industry operates, how the players differentiate themselves, what people in the industry are focused on. I just don't think there's, you know, that and going to the actual conferences, right? Like the industry conferences rather than sell side. I don't think there's a substitute for that either.
I agree. I don't think there's a substitute for those industry specific journals or the expert network calls and transcripts. I was actually talking to a hedge fund manager, just quick sort of funny story. And he was telling me that when they interview candidates, they ask them, which expert network platform are you using? Not are you using one? It's
interesting.
It's there's no substitute these days, according to this one firm. It's which one are you using?
What have you? Did you get an answer? What were some of the options, or what are you hearing most often?
I think the two that I've heard most often are Tegas and AlphaSense.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So maybe two questions left. What investors do you try to learn from the most? Maybe like what investor letters are you reading, or if you look at 13Fs, what firms are you looking at the 13Fs of?
Yeah. So I would say, and I think I've started out here, right? Like I'd say investors in general are a very confident bunch. Which is funny to me because, you know, one of the things I always, we've got a 10-year-old, boy at home. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I often remind him is, you know, cause he's getting to the year, getting close to those teenage years where they know everything already.
Right.
And I have to constantly remind him, like, listen, if you already know everything, you know, you really have nothing to learn. Uh-huh. Right. And, you know, I often feel the same way about hedge fund managers, right? They tend to know everything about everything, which means that their starting point is they're not trying to learn anything. They're trying more to just prove everything that they know. We come from, we operate under a different assumption, and that's that we know nothing. So I try to keep as open-minded as possible, and I try to approach every interaction with the thought that there's something I can learn from this person.
Yes.
Doesn't matter who it is, right? The reality is like, there's very few things that we're expert on or we're going to know better than everyone on the planet, which means almost everyone else will be able to teach you something. Mm-hmm. In terms of particular investors we respect and read, I thought that was interesting, right? So I started my career at a big bank on Wall Street in the 90s and then left in the early 2000s to join this small family office in rural North Carolina. Blogs were not around at the time. Substacks were not around at the time. FinTwit was not around at the time. Right. And so, you know, I had grown up in an environment where, the training program was top notch. It was a great place to learn how to analyze the business, but everything that I learned came from inside of that bank, that large, prestigious investment bank, investment management firm. All the internal research, everything was internal. And so then I found myself on an island or in the mountains in North Carolina, needing access to data, needing access to information. So I started, I mean, I don't think it was until after I left, after I joined Broyhill that I've read, you know, the Berkshire Hathaway letters cover to cover, or read, and even before then, right, Warren Buffett's partnership letters, right, prior that preceded Berkshire Hathaway. Yep. And then same thing, you know, next up was all of Klarman's letters at Baupost, which I think probably more than anything influenced our way of investing. Right, Klarman does not short stocks. You know, has, you know, will have hedges on the portfolio periodically, but entirely bottom up driven. Yep. Another investor, which, you know, probably less familiar to, you know, traditional value investors, the family has been invested with Paul Singer at Elliott for, you know, over a decade.
Yeah.
Paul is probably the single best risk manager in the world. Wow. His letters are somewhat of a chore. You know, if people think that reading us is a little bit bearish, you'd want to put away sharp objects before reading anything from Singer. You know, it's like 30, 40 pages every quarter of anything and everything that can go wrong and that's wrong in the world.
Right.
But like track record speaks for itself.
Exactly.
You know, I remember at one point early in my career hearing from Seth that he read everything and everything that Jim Grant published. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've subscribed to Grant's for about as long as, you know, since I heard that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, love Jason Zweig, I think, is a phenomenal thinker and writer. And then, yeah, you've got the usual, you know, you mentioned Mobison before, right? There's just, you know, he's, you know, godlike status in the industry. I think I struggle to even think of someone that even writes along the, you know, offers up the same types of insights as him, right? Yeah. Like maybe, you know, maybe De Motorin, you know, puts out some interesting stuff, you know, on tech. And then there's just, I mean, it's incredible, right? There's just, there's so much good content out there today. It's just, it's so much more important to have just a, it makes having a good filter that much more important, right? Even just, you know, there's Substacks that are just, you know, relatively unknown or anonymous folks that, you know, may in some cases have zero investing experience that are putting out some of the highest quality stuff we've seen.
I agree. There's some really good deep dives out there on Substack. I agree. Yeah. We covered a lot. I'm a big fan and believer in Broyhill and you as the CIO and its process. Is there anything we missed or anything else you'd like us to know about Broyhill, its process, or how the team works?
Yeah, well, first of all, I very much appreciate the kind words and, you know, hope we can and look forward to keeping in touch, John. So happy happy to do this anytime. It's been
Chris.
Fun.
Thank you.
Would say, you know, probably the big takeaway here and what I think makes Broyhill unique is really the culture that we've been building, diversity of perspectives on the team, and this blend of arts and sciences or left brain, right brain thinking, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. that we try to approach every decision with. I think that perspective is what differentiates us. And what results in a very different portfolio than the market, very different portfolio than more traditional value investors. And we hope that a very different portfolio should lead to very different results over time. And so I'd just say, you know, folks are interested in learning more, they could spend a bit of time on the website, reading some of the stuff we published. I think it's, you know, should be pretty obvious pretty quickly. It's not your typical investor website. And the stuff we put out, I don't think is your typical investment commentary. As you said, I think that's probably one of the advantages we have in being founded in the Blue Ridge Mountains is that, you know, we operate outside of the fray, and really try to approach things with an independent and rational long-term perspective.
Well said. And yes, I also recommend everyone checks out the Broyhill website. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And I do want to stay in touch and have you on again in the future.
Looking forward. Thanks, Sean.
Awesome. Before we sign off, I'd like to provide a quick reminder. Anything discussed on the JRO show by myself or my guests is solely our own opinions and does not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. The JRO show is for entertainment purposes only, so please do your own research on any securities discussed in this podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.